Good evening. My name is Carrie Michael, and you're listening to Speak Up Arkansas on KABF 88.3 FM. The Delta variant is raging across the country, and to date, only about 37% of our state's population has been fully vaccinated. There's a lot of information floating around. Not all of it is accurate or helpful, and that's led to many people feeling hesitant about getting vaccinated. Tonight on Speak Up Arkansas, we'll address some commonly asked questions about the vaccine. We're bringing some questions that we often hear from our clients, and we couldn't have a better person here to answer them. Dr. Jennifer Dillahay is the Arkansas Department of Health's Medical Director for Immunizations, and she's been good enough to join us today. And DRA Legal and Advocacy Director Thomas Nichols is back with us to help address some of the questions many Arkansans have about the vaccine. We'll also talk about some barriers to vaccination for people with disabilities and what DRA is doing to help address those barriers. What you need to know to keep yourself, your loved ones, and your community safe. The COVID vaccine tonight on Speak Up Arkansas. We're excited to be a part of Speak Up Arkansas's program to encourage dialogue about the issues that matter most to people with disabilities, their families and caregivers, and to educate the public about these issues. To make Arkansas a truly inclusive state where everyone's personhood and contributions are valued. This show is pre-recorded, so we won't be taking calls, but we welcome your questions and comments. Give us a call at 800-482-1174, or you can find us online at www.disabilityrightsar.org. We're also on Facebook at Disability Rights AR and on Twitter at DR Arkansas. Dr. Dillahay and Thomas Nichols, thank you all so much for joining us for this important conversation.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you.
So Thomas, you've been talking to our clients and talking to the community and talking to lots of different people who have questions. I know that you've kind of pulled together a list of some of those questions, and we couldn't have anybody better here to answer them. So I'm going to let you kind of jump in with and fire away.
Thank you. And Dr. Dillahay, I want to say we're thrilled to have you on to talk about this very, very important subject. So let's just jump right in. We talk with lots of folks on a daily basis, and in those conversations, naturally, the pandemic, COVID in general, masks, vaccinations, they all come up in conversation. And one of the really important focuses that we've had as directed by our federal grant funders is to promote vaccination and make sure that people understand that it is a thing that we all need to be considering in order to get back to the way things were. So let's start with what is, for those who might not know, what is the vaccination and how does a vaccination work?
Sure. So a vaccine is a pharmaceutical product that we use to stimulate the human's immune system to make lasting immunity. Really, what they do is they give the person's immune system a running head start. When a person encounters a new virus, for example, their immune system has to go through certain steps of learning how to recognize that virus. Once it learns to recognize it, then it turns itself on with antibodies and with cells that fight the virus. Well, with a vaccine, what you do is you give the person an injection usually, but some vaccines you can give by the mouth. You know, people can swallow the vaccine. And it has something that looks like the virus, but is not the virus necessarily, but it's enough like it that the immune system goes through those steps of learning to recognize it. So when it encounters the real virus, for example, it doesn't have to go through those initial steps. It can begin to fight the virus right away. And that's really important for the COVID vaccines, because the virus that causes COVID-19 can actually start producing illness within just a few days, which is too short of a period of time for the immune system to learn to recognize it. So the virus that causes COVID-19 gets a head start. It takes a week or so for the immune system to really kick in and start to fight the virus, sometimes a little longer, depending on the health of the person who got infected. But if it doesn't have to go through those steps, because it's already gone through them because of the vaccine, then it can immediately begin to fight the virus. And sometimes that's good enough to keep the person completely from getting infected. Other times they still get infected, but it's good enough to keep them out of the hospital or keep them from dying.
That's wonderful. So these vaccines, the ones that were developed for COVID-19, we know that there's three of them. And we also know that, or at least we have anecdotally heard about how it takes so long, research and development takes so long for nearly all medications. At least that's what we believe at large, again, anecdotally. How were these particular medications, these vaccinations, developed on such a short timeline?
Sure. So technology that they're using to make these vaccines for Pfizer and Moderna is the mRNA technology. That has been under development for many years. I did my training in infectious diseases in the 1990s. And I remember reading about it then, and it's been used in the cancer field a lot. So that was good because you can make vaccines using the mRNA technology a lot more quickly than some of the other technologies they use to make vaccines. The other things that helped us was there had already been done a lot of research about developing vaccines for SARS, which was a coronavirus illness that spread around the world in the early 2000s. And then there's another coronavirus disease they had been working on a vaccine for called MERS. It stands for Middle East Respiratory Syndrome. This is a coronavirus that camels carry, and humans that camels can get from them. And when humans get it, it's really deadly. So they had been working on these vaccines for MERS and SARS. So they already knew what the target of the immune system was for coronaviruses, which is the spike protein. The spike protein is on the surface of the virus, and the when a virus bumps into human cells and the spike protein connects with a certain protein on human cells called a angiotensin converting enzyme 2, we call it ACE2 protein for short, it sticks to it, locks onto it, and then uses that to enter the cell and take over the cell and reproduce itself. So they already knew how this worked before COVID-19 came along. And they had already done a lot of the preliminary clinical studies about how the vaccine would work. And so what they really needed for the COVID-19 or the new SARS coronavirus was the genetic sequence for the spike protein. And when the Chinese published the genetic sequence for the virus on the internet in mid-January, these companies that had been working on the other coronavirus vaccines had a candidate vaccine ready to go the next day. And they had already done a lot of the clinical studies so they could build on what they had done and complete the clinical studies that they needed for animals very rapidly, and then start the clinical studies in humans within a couple of months. Well, usually when we do clinical trials for humans, we do a phase one, and that's followed by a phase two and a phase three. And you would never start a phase two unless you knew that phase one worked, because they were very expensive and a pharmaceutical company would not take that risk. So the U.S. government gave the pharmaceutical companies a contract and fronted that money for them. So it wasn't a risk for the pharmaceutical companies. So they did phase one, which is less than 100 people. And what you're trying to do in phase one is determine, is this vaccine safe to give to people? And before it was finished, they could start enrolling people. They could afford to start enrolling people in phase two. And in phase two, what you're trying to see, is this vaccine likely to work? So they divide the participants in phase two, it's a few hundred people, into a group that got the vaccine and a group that got the placebo. And then what you do with that is you wait and see if they're exposed to the virus, and then you see if they were protected or not. If that goes well, then they would move to a phase three, which is a few thousand people. But you wouldn't move to a phase three unless you had already done that small study to see if it would work or likely work. Well, now with the funding that the government was able to provide for the development of these vaccines, they could scale up into phase three very quickly. And to make sure that the vaccines were as safe as possible, they didn't enroll just a few thousand people. They enrolled tens of thousands of people, 40, 50, 60,000 people on some of these vaccines. And so they were able to complete the study very quickly for the phase three trial. There's two factors that determine how long the phase three trial is. One is it has to be at least 8 weeks long. And that's because we know that the common adverse events or severe side effects of vaccines will occur within the first 6 weeks after a vaccine is given. The rare side effects won't show up in a phase three clinical trial because there's not enough people enrolled. So if you have a rare side effect that occurs one out of every 100,000 or one or two or three out of every million people, you won't see that in a phase three clinical trial. But you will see the more common ones, and they're all within the first 6 weeks. So the FDA requires that the trial be at least 8 weeks long. And then how much longer it is depends on how much spread of the illness there is in the community. Because you want the people who are enrolled, a certain number of people have to get infected in order for you to be able to see did the vaccine protect or not. Well, at the time that these vaccines were being studied in their phase three trials, there was a ton of spread of COVID-19 in the US. So they could very quickly achieve their exposure numbers and then analyze the results to see if it was safe and effective. And then they turned their data over to the FDA to analyze to see if they would give them emergency use authorization. And the FDA does their own analysis of the data. They don't just accept what people, the pharmaceutical company gives them. They do their own analysis. And they did it very expeditiously by dividing their staff into shift and running shifts 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to analyze the data timely for the vaccines to be authorized. So when the pharmaceutical companies submitted their data to the FDA, they had already completed the safety and the efficacy part of the trials. What remained was how long does the protection last? Well, they could keep studying that while they made the vaccine that had been shown to be safe and to work and get that early to the American people, because in the meantime, thousands of people were dying. So the FDA now has the remainder part of the data of the how long does the protection last, as well as they license the manufacturing process. So there's data for that. And how do you store the vaccine? Because it has to be stored in specific conditions to maintain its viability. So all of that has been submitted to the FDA for analysis for full licensure. And we think that that may be, will be completed in a few weeks, perhaps. It just depends on how long it takes the FDA to do their analysis.
That's great. That is a lot of information, and it raises a lot of questions that you answered along the way, but things that I want to go back to and talk a little bit about. So that first clinical trial, the phase one of the clinical trials on the vaccine is to find out if it's safe. If we give it to somebody, is it going to hurt them? And you had mentioned a little bit later on that these adverse events that might happen when somebody's vaccinated might happen sometime in that 6-week window. So what do we know now about adverse events that happen due to the vaccine? Can you talk about that for a little bit?
Sure.
I had thought that most, and I had told people, not any of our callers or anything, but I had told people privately that I understood most adverse events to vaccines happen within the course of, 48, 72 hours or immediately after you get the vaccine.
Sure. So there's two ways of looking at adverse events. Of course, there's the expected side effects. So when someone gets the shot, you would expect that a certain proportion of the people would have pain where they got the shot. It would hurt. And it might get red, get hot. Some people had swollen lymph nodes under their arms. And then some people had systemic effects, like they ran a fever, they had fatigue, they just felt ill. Some people actually, felt like they had maybe the flu or something like that. And those generally lasted about a day or two and resolved. Some people, about a week after they got the vaccine, got a red and swollen area on their arm, and then it went away. And some of the effects were greater with the second dose than the first dose, and the older you were, the less likely you were to have these side effects that were troublesome. And so the clinical trials identified all of these, and we knew what to expect when people got vaccinated. There were really no other adverse events. And so what an adverse event would be is a severe reaction that wasn't expected. It's not part of those anticipated expected side effects. So they didn't find much in the trials. So when the vaccines were made available to the public, then there became reports of people having severe allergic reactions. Some cases call it anaphylaxis. And over time, they were able to find that occurred in between 3 and 5 out of every million people who got vaccinated. And then over time, they found that with the Janssen vaccine, there were some people who developed something called thrombotic and thrombocytopenia, syndrome, or TTS for short, which is a lot easier to say. So they found that of the about 13 million doses of the Janssen vaccine, there were just under 40 people who were reported to have TTS. And this have been a concern because a few of those people died. Those are the only people that have been over time had any sort of a correlation with death in the vaccines. The way we find those rare events is that we have a system for reporting adverse events. So anyone can report. The person who gets vaccinated can report, a family member, the pharmacy or the clinic that gave the vaccine, or the hospital, or anyone can report. And there's some adverse events that you're required to report. So if someone ends up in the hospital, or if they die after the vaccine, even if you aren't really sure the vaccine caused it, you're still required to report it because we don't want to miss anything. And so over time, with the analysis that's been done and the review of the records, because the CDC investigates all of the adverse events that are severe that have been reported, including deaths, they have found that there's no association, correlation with death and these vaccines, aside from what I mentioned with the TTS. So that's kind of what we find. We know so far everything that's been reported of the side effects occurs within the last 6 weeks or the 6 weeks after people get vaccinated. Although some of the events, like if someone gets COVID-19 and they've been fully vaccinated and they end up in the hospital, that's required to be reported. That can be a lot longer than 6 weeks, but that's not really an adverse event from the vaccine. That's just someone getting COVID and going to the hospital because the vaccine didn't protect them.
Sure, sure. And so when you look at the number of events that you know, admittedly may or may not have been caused by the vaccine itself, how does that relate to the risk of getting vaccinated? How does that relate to the risk of getting COVID and experiencing significant illness, hospitalization, yeah, or even death?
So the CDC has an advisory committee called, it's the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, or ACIP, we call it for short. They review all of these data to make sure that the risk of COVID is still greater than the risk of the vaccine. Otherwise, they couldn't recommend it. They review it on a regular basis. They're meeting today, actually, and I don't know if they'll be reviewing safety data, but I know they're reviewing possible recommendations for a third dose for people who are immunocompromised. But just as an example, the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines, there have been cases of young adults, mostly male adults or adolescents, getting myocarditis, which is inflammation of the heart, after they've gotten the Pfizer or the Moderna vaccines. So what has been determined so far is about something over 700 cases reported. And the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has looked into it, and they're still continuing to study it. But what they're finding is that these have been mild cases of myocarditis. They resolve within a few days under usual treatment. Occasionally, they have been admitted to the hospital for monitoring. So I'm aware of one person admitted to Children's Hospital in Arkansas with mild illness. They were there briefly. Compared to many, many children admitted to Children's Hospital due to COVID-19 and admitted to the intensive care unit and put on the ventilator. These are not kids who have been vaccinated. And the people, kids that get vaccinated do fine with the vaccine. They don't see admissions due to the vaccine in children's, aside from that one that I'm aware of. There may have been a few others in Arkansas, but the risk of COVID-19 and the severity of the disease and the complications that it can cause are much, much higher, about 1,000 times higher for myocarditis.
Sure. Another thing you said when you were talking about earlier, when describing how the vaccines work, you mentioned mRNA. And so obviously we have heard lots of questions from people about when they see mRNA, and they might know just enough, right, to question what that does and whether that is somehow going to impact the genetic information in your body, whether it's going to do something long-term. So if you could, will you talk a little bit about mRNA and how that is misunderstood a lot of times?
Oh, sure. So when a human cell wants to make a protein, the DNA or on their chromosomes, which are in the nucleus of the cell, unravels a little bit and an mRNA copy is made of it. And that mRNA copy of the gene goes into the outside part of the cell, the cytoplasm. It's outside the nucleus, but within the cell where the machinery is that makes proteins. So you get an mRNA for any kind of protein you want to make. There's tons of mRNAs that the cells turn on and turn off to make proteins whenever it needs them. And then once the protein is made, that mRNA is dismantled and it's gotten rid of. And then it will make more mRNA if it needs more protein in the future. So that's kind of how proteins are made in cells. So what the vaccine does for Pfizer and Moderna is they give the cell directly the mRNA because they want it to make the spike protein. So the mRNA goes into the cytoplasm of the cell and it makes the spike protein. And then the immune system learns to recognize that spike protein. It never goes into the nucleus. It can't change the DNA. mRNA never goes back into the nucleus. It can't change the DNA. So if you understand cell biology, you realize that mRNA is very fragile. It doesn't stay around very long. It gets broken down and the components get reused for the future work that the cell does. But the mRNA for the spike protein that goes into the vaccine and then into the cell, just the cell just treats it like any other mRNA that it would make. It makes the protein and then it dismantles the mRNA. So after about a day or hours, actually, the mRNA is just not even there anymore.
Right. And then when the immune system sees that spike protein later on, it can then attack it and say, hey, that doesn't belong here, like it did with the initial spike protein that's created, right?
Sure. So that's really important thing. And the body doesn't keep making the spike protein. It just makes it for a transient period of time while the mRNA is there, and then it's gone. But the immune system remembers it.
Yeah. And so we're talking about the immune system. Can you talk a little bit why vaccination is going to be better than just the body's natural immune response to this particular disease?
Sure. So, you know, there are some viruses that humans get when they get infected and develop immunity, they develop lifelong immunity to those viruses. And there are some viruses that humans get infected with, and they never develop lifelong immunity to them. And the immunity wanes over time, and they can get infected with those viruses again and again. So there's four coronaviruses that cause the common cold that we humans get about 40% of the common cold. And our immunity for those coronaviruses wanes over time, and we can get them again and again. And that's why we keep getting colds, because our immunity wanes. Well, it appears that with the coronaviruses that cause COVID-19, that it's similar. We don't develop permanent immunity to that coronavirus. We develop some immunity for a period of time, but it likely wanes over time. So there's one way to measure immunity, and that is by drawing blood and checking the level of antibodies. What we're looking for is what we call neutralizing antibodies. They're the ones that stick to the spike protein and block it and keep it from the virus from infecting cells. So we know that the level of neutralizing antibodies that people develop varies with how sick they got with COVID-19. So the people who are more severely ill have higher levels of neutralizing antibody than people who had mild illness. But in general, the level of neutralizing antibodies that people develop after becoming fully vaccinated is higher than anything with the natural infection. And then if the immunity wanes, then of course we can get another dose of the vaccine. We would not want to risk having to keep our immunity up by getting COVID again and again. We know that people have gotten COVID more than once. There was a study just recently published that compared people who had COVID and got vaccinated afterwards to people who got COVID and didn't get vaccinated afterwards. And the people who didn't get vaccinated were more than twice as likely to get COVID again. And you don't know how bad the variant is that you're gonna get again. And so we just really encourage people to get their immunity through vaccination. It's a lot safer, and the probability of having any lasting long-term complications are much, much lower than getting with the vaccine than you would have if you got COVID-19.
Right, and the risk is so great, you don't know if you're going to have very serious illness or even death as a result of catching the disease, but you also don't know if you are going to catch a virus that is the beginning of another variant that's even worse than one that we've seen, whether it's more infectious or whether it's more likely to cause serious illness. How quickly can those variants develop?
Well, the reason that COVID-19 or the virus that causes COVID-19 develops variants is because when a person gets infected, the virus multiplies itself, it replicates itself. And when it replicates, some of the copies have mutations or mistakes in them. Most of the mistakes or the variants are of no consequence. It doesn't change how the virus acts or not. But sometimes they do, and like the Delta variant, it got mutations in the spike protein that made it a lot more stickier to human cells so that it can more easily infect them. And then there's other mutations that have that work toward making the illness more severe and so forth. So every time someone gets infected with the Delta variant, it has mutations. And will those mutations give it an advantage for infecting more people and causing more severe disease? Well, it could. So over time, we could end up something worse than with the Delta variant. That's why it's so important for everyone to do whatever they can to suppress the spread of COVID-19, because the less spread, the less replications, or the less opportunity for replications the virus has, and the less opportunity for mutating. So getting vaccinated, wearing masks, practicing social distancing are all ways to help decrease the spread and decrease the opportunity for the virus to gain additional mutations.
Okay. I have gotten lots of questions from folks who are pregnant, who are thinking about getting pregnant, and obviously I don't know how to critically read journal articles. I don't have that background information to understand more than sentences here and there. So if I read something that might seem to me, who I'm frankly, I am just a lawyer, I don't do science. So some of those journal articles, if you don't understand what you're reading, can be a little terrifying. So can you talk a little bit about people who are pregnant or who are thinking about getting pregnant, the vaccination, how there might be a perception of it affecting fertility or of it affecting a or terminating even a pregnancy, and what the data shows with regard to any of those claims?
Sure. So when the vaccines were first made available to the American public, there wasn't any reason to think it would be harmful to pregnant women. So they were permitted to get the vaccine if they made a decision with their doctor to do so. Over time, it became really clear that the women who were getting the vaccines were not having problems from the vaccines, but women who were pregnant that were getting COVID-19 were ending up in the hospital, dying or losing their babies or coming close to dying or going on heart lung bypass machines. They were having severe problems. So over time, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, and these are the doctors that treat infertility, by the way, they recommended that pregnant women get vaccinated. The American Society of Maternal and Fetal Medicine also recommended that pregnant women get the vaccine, and the CDC now has also recommended it. And there was so much misinformation about the vaccine causing infertility out there that the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists finally put a statement on their website stating there is no medical evidence that the COVID vaccines affect fertility at all. But it's quite believable to many people because you hear it all the time and they think the more times you hear it, the more likely it's to be true, but it's really not true. It's the same misinformation being repeated and repeated and repeated.
And I'm trying not to editorialize this, but it is pretty rare for ACOG to quickly come out and say something unequivocally like that, at least in my understanding of it, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. So let's talk about some of the other claims that we have heard. Probably better to get vaccinated than it is to take something, some type of over-the-counter or other type of medication instead of taking the vaccine. We've heard about ivermectin, which is used in cows or as a cattle dewormer as some type of preventative or therapeutic medication. Can you talk a little bit about why we aren't recommending that as either a therapeutic or a preventative treatment?
So when the FDA licenses a product, they look at the studies that show, is the product safe and does it work? And ivermectin has been licensed for humans, but not for treatment of any viral illnesses. Now, the FDA has allowed certain treatments to be used under the emergency use authorization because they're promising and the evidence shows that they are likely to work. And then as time goes on, if they get more evidence that it works, that the FDA can license them, but if there's evidence that they're not working or even harmful, then they would revoke the emergency use authorization. So that's the process by which the treatments for COVID-19 are going through right now. The National Institutes of Health has a panel that reviews all the studies to make treatment recommendations for COVID-19. And they have looked at all of the studies that are related to ivermectin, and they have said that there at this point in time is not enough evidence to either recommend for the use of ivermectin or against ivermectin. So we want people to be safe, and we hope people will make an informed decision. The COVID vaccine has been authorized under emergency use authorization because it has been shown to be safe and effective in preventing COVID-19, as well as the severe disease, hospitalizations, and death. And so that's different from what the FDA or the National Institutes of Health has said about ivermectin. We don't have enough evidence one way or the other to know whether it works or not. So it cannot be recommended for or against.
And certainly the thought of going out and buying it off of a shelf and figuring out somehow your dose, and that's probably not going to be as safe or as effective as just getting the vaccine.
Well, and I worry about the dosing. You know, some people, if they buy it for cattle, for example, that's 1,500 pounds. Most people don't weigh that much. And if they were to dose themselves, I'm afraid they may harm themselves.
Yeah. So let's switch gears a little bit to another claim. Are vaccinated people really super spreaders? And how is that playing out in the data?
Okay. So in the springtime, when the Alpha variant was the dominant variant, the CDC found that with people who were fully vaccinated, meaning 2 weeks after their second dose of Pfizer or Moderna, or 2 weeks after their one dose of Janssen, that they were less likely to get infected with a virus that causes COVID-19. But if they did get infected, they had very low levels of virus in their nose and respiratory passages. So they were unlikely to spread it. And at that time, they said, you know, people who are fully vaccinated probably don't need to wear masks. Well, then the Delta variant came in, and it is a game changer. And for people who are unvaccinated, who get the Delta variant and don't wear masks, they are twice as likely to spread COVID-19 than people who had the Alpha variant, and probably four times as likely for the original variant that came from into the US when the pandemic first hit. So it's much more infectious, and it's because the viral load in the nasal passages that people have is probably 1,000 times higher with the Delta variant than the other variants that we had prior to the Delta variant. So what we're finding is that people who are fully vaccinated can still get infected with the Delta variant. Most people do not. Most recently, there was data out of the United Kingdom that showed about 8 out of 10 people were protected from illness. About 2 out of 10 people would get illness. And those people, from what we're finding, were able to spread it because the viral load or the burden of the virus in their nasal and respiratory passages were much higher than with the other variants. So then it became important for even people who are fully vaccinated to wear masks. Now, the vast majority of people who are spreading COVID-19 in Arkansas are the people who are not vaccinated. We know that just about less than 40% of the population is fully vaccinated. So any one of them that gets infected could spread it. We know that the people who are fully vaccinated, most of them will not get illness. Some of them will, but they could spread it if they did get ill with COVID-19. So people who are not fully vaccinated are not super spreaders. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
I want to.
That's okay.
Back up. I said people who are fully vaccinated are not super spreaders. I flipped my words. We are worried about the spread of COVID-19 from those who are not vaccinated.
Yeah. And speaking of vaccination and illness developing, we've seen obviously that there are places where lots of vaccinated people are developing illness. And I think, what was it? Provincetown, was that the name of the city where you had a lot of vaccinated people who became ill, but they weren't getting necessarily hospitalized at the same rate or weren't dying at the same rate?
Yeah, so what we're finding that vaccinated people can have what we call breakthrough illness. So on the health department's website, we do put information about the proportion of people who are cases and people in the hospital and people who die, what proportion are fully vaccinated and what proportion are not. So right now, of all the active cases, about 15% are people who are fully vaccinated. That means 85% of the people who have COVID right now are not fully vaccinated. And it's about, since the beginning of February, of all the cases, less than about 90% or more have been not fully vaccinated. Less than 10% have been fully vaccinated, and so forth. So you can follow that on the website. You know, our concern is that eventually we may get a variant where the vaccine does not protect people very well, and we're monitoring it closely to see if that does occur so that we can take the appropriate steps. But right now, the vast majority of people who are cases in the hospital and dying are people who are not fully vaccinated.
Okay. Kids, the new variant obviously is affecting children more than the previous variant. What do people need to know about how vaccination can help children who might not be eligible for the vaccine at this time? And when will our young ones be able to get vaccinated?
So right now, the Pfizer vaccine is authorized for kids 12 years of age and older. There are clinical studies underway for kids 5 through 11 years of age, and we hope those will be completed next month or the month after, and it will be authorized for that age group, which is the school age group. So we are wanting kids to be able to attend school successfully this year, which means to protect them from COVID-19, everyone around them needs to be vaccinated. Older siblings, parents, anyone in the household, as well as caregivers, teachers, and the staff, and anyone associated with the aftercare programs or activities that kids do after school. They all need to be vaccinated to protect these kids. And these kids need to wear masks. If everybody's wearing a mask, then the level of spread of COVID will be much reduced compared to only if some or a few people wear masks. That's also very important. And then social distancing in the classroom, maintaining spaces, and there's strategies that schools can employ to reduce spread. It's going to be really important for everyone to do their part to help keep the schools open.
That is a huge topic of conversation that we're hearing about right now. And I so appreciate your addressing it. I want to, in the time that we have remaining, I'd like to shift to sort of thinking about and talking about efforts to ensure that the Arkansans who have not yet been vaccinated are able to get access to that. And of course, the disability community has its own set of barriers to that. I'd love for, you know, Thomas and also Dr. Dillahay to speak to how we can ensure that those who have barriers, you know, are still able to access the vaccine and stay safe.
Well, let me start and then maybe Thomas can add to it. First of all, we want to know that people to know that the vaccines are no cost to them. So all vaccinators receive the vaccine free. The U.S. government has paid for it. If you have insurance, they can bill the insurance for the cost to administer the vaccine, but they do not ask for payment from the patient. If you are asked for payment, it's a scam and do not pay it. The other thing that we want people to know is that we have Pfizer and Moderna and Janssen vaccine available in every county in the state. So if you want a particular vaccine or you just want to go somewhere where there is a vaccine, then you can call the health department's 1-800 number. It's 1-800-985-6030. 1-800-985-6030. They will be able to tell you a location nearby. It's available in doctor's offices, pharmacies, in the Arkansas Department of Health local health units, as well as some hospitals around the state. So it's important for people to know if they have a disability where they're homebound, that we can arrange for vaccine to be brought to them, and not just them, but everyone else in the household. Caregivers can get it too, can arrange for them all to be there. Friends that want to come visit you, want to get vaccinated, they'll vaccinate them too. So call the 1-800-985-6030 and we will make arrangements for a pharmacist to come and bring the vaccine to anyone in the household that would like to have it.
What a wonderful resource. And we will make sure that that is also in our show notes when we post this show to our website. It will be there for our folks. We'll certainly share it at DRA's social media. People need to know that for sure, that y'all can come to them. Thomas, you were going to
That's a phenomenal service that's available. You know, one of the biggest barriers to people with disabilities in accessing medical care as a general rule in this state is transportation to and from the doctor. Even though, you know, non-emergency medical transportation is a service if you have Medicaid, there are many people who just do not have access to that transportation. So the thought that the state has identified this as such an important issue that they are going to send pharmacists to your house to provide you with this life-saving medication potentially. It really speaks to the belief in the efficacy and the safety of this and how necessary it is to getting ourselves back to some sense of normalcy. Nobody wants to wear a mask. I don't want to wear a mask. You know, my wife doesn't want to wear, my 6-year-old doesn't want to wear a mask, right? We want to be able to go out. We want to be able to see our friends, to see our family. We want to be able to do it safely. And especially so, we have people who are in congregate settings, residential treatment facilities, intermediate care facilities, nursing homes. We want those folks to be safe. Viral diseases, contagious diseases, they spread very rapidly through those populations.
Oh, yeah.
And those populations have lots of times co-occurring illnesses. Lots of people might be immunocompromised. They might have pre-existing heart conditions that might make severe disease, hospitalization, or death even more likely. So all of us getting vaccinated helps prevent a variant that might be vaccine resistant, helps prevent disease from getting into these facilities. So all the more important, if you call us, we will set you up with the Department of Health so that you can have one of these house calls. If you have questions, if you're vaccine hesitant, we try to work you through those issues as best we can, just based on what we know and understand, but we will absolutely reach out to the Department of Health on your behalf. We will send you to the Department of Health, whatever it is you want to allay your fears about this being the way we are going to get back to where we were.
Dr. Dillahay, thank you for being so willing to address all these questions and also for your tireless efforts to fight this virus and help keep Arkansans safe and informed. We will let you go. Thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's an honor to be able to be with you today. Thank you.
And Thomas, thank you for compiling these questions. I do want to give our listeners that 800 number from the Department of Health one more time. That's 800-985-6030. Give them your location. They can help hook you up. If you would like, DRA can help you, help connect you as well. 800-482-1174. All of that will be in our show notes. Thank you both so much. Y'all stay safe out there, and we will see you next time on Speak Up Arkansas.